Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
To some people, yesterday was April Fool's Day. To high school seniors and their families, it was the day they've been anxiously awaiting all year, the last day for colleges and universities to announce who got in and who is rejected or waitlisted for next fall. Congratulations or condolences to all of you in that boat. But my next guest, Anya Kamenetz, wants to blow up the whole existing model of higher education and how it's financed. You may know Anya Kamenetz from her last book, Generation Debt, her writing in Fast Company, and her many appearances on this program to lift the veil on the credit card and student loan industries and how they take us for a ride. Now Anya has a new book that does the same for higher education. It's called DIYU, Edupunks, Edupreneurs, and the Coming Transformation of Higher Education. It even includes a reference to this program. Hi, Anya. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for that introduction.
And let's start with the part about what happened on this show that begins chapter three of your book, because I actually think it's pretty central. On the day of the Obama-McCain presidential debate at Hofstra University in 2008, we went out there and did this program from the Hofstra campus. You were a guest, and someone asked Hofstra Provost Herman Berliner why tuition goes up so much faster at colleges than overall inflation, about 6 or 7% a year in Hofstra's case, and this answer made it into your book.
We've been going up about 6 or 7% a year, but you really have to put that in context. If you have many classes that have only 15 or 20 students in the class, if you provide students with a lot of additional services, very different than when I went to college in terms of counseling and advisement and a host of other co-curricular activities, a recreation center that really is as fancy as any, you know, athletic club. If students are looking for all those extras in terms of their education and they're looking for a very personal education and a very small student-faculty ratio, the costs are going to go up.
And that was quite an honest answer, though you're right, Anya, that he inadvertently revealed the real reasons for tuition inflation. Why did you write that moment up?
Well, because I really saw it, as you said, as a moment, and not only that, but, you know, the whole venue of hosting a college, the presidential debate there, was itself an expenditure of millions of dollars, also for marketing purposes. And everything that he's talking about has to do with the decision that colleges like Hofstra make to market themselves and present themselves for all types of things that have nothing to do necessarily with the quality of the education itself. Beyond that, the parents and families are really locked into paying this because they believe, and it's so commonly believed, that getting that college degree, a prestigious degree from a private university, is the only way to get any kind of decent middle-class life.
Do you think the reasons that he gave, wanting all these perks and, you know, the high-class fitness center and the very low student-teacher ratios, all that stuff, other kinds of amenities in the dorms, do you think that's typical nationwide?
Well, there are really two stories in college costs that I get into in DIYU. The cost structure in general is growing. It's growing much more on the private university side. In the public university realm, there's an additional factor, which is that public support for our higher education institutions has been declining. And colleges, rather than cut the costs, so, you know, whether public or private, colleges seem very allergic to the idea of cost cutting. Rather than cut the costs on the public side, they've been shifting towards tuition. So actually, on the percentage side, public university tuition has grown even more than private university tuition.
And not to dump on Hofstra, but you place it in what you call the worst value for money quadrant in higher education, private but non-elite, and costing $40,000 a year. Can you put that in context for us? Are there a lot of schools like that?
You know, there's a fair number of them, and they're really caused by there's a nationwide market now for higher education, so students are coming from everywhere to anywhere, and they're competing through the U.S. News and World Report, so there are far more universities that might in previous decades have been regional or happy to be local, and they're now all trying to crowd up into this top tier, and that is one factor behind the perks war.
But why do people spend money? I mean, maybe the perks war is the answer, but why do people spend money on private, non-elite colleges? I mean, I could see if if your grades and your other record is good enough to get you into Stanford or MIT or something like that, you know, for an elite university, maybe there are benefits that that could bring. Why would anyone go to, say, Hofstra over SUNY?
Well, I really don't want this to be about Hofstra. I'm sure I'm going to get angry calls from alumni. But I think the real issue is that people do not know what they're getting when they get a college degree. We do not have a nationwide conversation about productivity in higher education. What is our students learning, right? What kind of experiences are most important to people's success? Colleges talk about their inputs. They talk about the students' SAT scores when they're coming in and the selectivity that they have, you know, how many people they screen out. They do not talk openly about their outputs. They don't talk about how many students drop out, which is 54% get a degree, so 44% or 46% are dropping out after 6 years. They don't talk about the salaries people get or whether people feel satisfied with their degrees or whether their degrees have anything to do with the lives they pursue. A lot of people find that their undergraduate majors don't have anything to do with anything. So in the absence of real information about college, parents and students are looking at the brochures, they're looking at the gym and all these other types of factors.
So let's broaden it out from there. Why do you call your book DIYU, Do It Yourself University? Are you suggesting people can bypass the existing institutions altogether?
I think that the tools are coming to play into place so that very soon in the next few years, yes, it's going to be a far more accepted way for people to assemble their own personal learning paths outside of the traditional institutions. The larger point of that, of course, is that I think the traditional institutions model is not sustainable.
Talk about that.
Well, the cost structure we already talked about, right? When you have something that goes up at twice the rate of inflation, and by the way, more than any other good or service, college tuition has increased since 1990. That's just not sustainable. It can't go on. The student loan market has been fueling some of this. I argue there's a dynamic similar to what happened with the mortgage industry, that student loans have been repackaged and securitized, and that has probably fed the run-up in tuition. Now there's been a credit crunch in the student loan market, and student loans have been reformed. So without that stream of money and without any, you know, without any foreseeable increase in the average median income, you're just going to have fewer people that actually can afford it. And that is, I mean, I think that's one of the major drivers of this technological transformation.
So let's open the phones for students, professors, college administrators, Provost Berliner. Do you want to call in and continue the conversation? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. People are already calling in. You can post your comments on this to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show for Anya Kamenetz, whose new book is called DIYU. And you can tell us, folks, what do you think of the exploding tuition costs and the extent to which our expectations cause them? What do you think about Anya's ideas for reinventing higher ed for kind of a user-generated 2.0 world? And we've just scratched the surface of those ideas. We'll continue. 212-433-9692. And are you surprised, Anya? All our lines are already full. And I want to, you know, reflect the optimism that's in your book, because you conclude, for example, by saying students today have more options for higher education than anyone has ever had at any time in history. The future is up to you. Those are the last words of your book. So
right.
Far from being about how people are trapped by these institutional failings and self-interests, you're telling how many alternatives there are. That's your main point?
Absolutely. I think, you know, it's such a cliche to say that we're living in the information age, but if you think about the traditional functions of a university, you know, you've got this content delivery, you've got to get a lot of intellectual content, you have socialization where you're meeting a community of people and getting initiated, and then finally you have accreditation where they stamp you and they say, you know, you're grade A material. The content, there's been a content revolution, right? We all realize that, you know, courseware alone, just if you just look at traditional courseware, there are reams of free and open lectures from the best lecturers in the world, textbooks, texts, and entire courses online for free. That's happened in the last 10 years. Socialization, our communities, the way that people communicate has totally been reinvented. Within the academic world, again, there's an open access journal movement. People are trading information freely. You know, academics are blogging and they're opening their conversations out to the wider world, so you can access those intellectual communities. What we're missing, the part of the puzzle that I argue is really missing, is this accreditation piece, where how can people find a new way of assembling these experiences, finding these communities, and then finally getting that stamp that says that they're okay.
For example, you introduced the idea of open educational resources or open content,
right,
like MIT course content, which that most elite of universities is actually offering for free in some cases. What's out there?
Well, MIT is doing it for free. Yale is doing it for free. Harvard's doing it for free. There's iTunes U. There's YouTube.edu. There is the Open Courseware Consortium with institutions in countries all over the world. And millions of people are accessing these either to supplement their learning, to learn on their own. And then there are new organizations like Peer-to-Peer University, which is a free online community where people are going to start classes around this open content and actually convene their own types of classes.
Why would these schools do that? If Harvard's charging $50,000 a year to go there, why would they give away course content for free?
Well, it's something that's really sweeping the whole internet, and I think Chris Anderson from Wired called it the freemium model, right? So people who go to MIT are paying to be at MIT with other MIT people, and that is a very valuable experience. I'm not talking about replacing the face-to-face experience, but they can expand their brand out and share for a minimal cost with the entire world, and people all around the world are hearing about MIT. And you know, and not beyond just the marketing aspect of it, it's a public mission of a university to share information, and the internet makes it so much easier.
Mike in Astoria is a skeptic. Mike, you're on WNYC with Anya Kamenetz. Hi.
Yeah, I just have one comment, one question. Basically, I don't know if you can expect an 18-year-old to plan their own curriculum like this and receive an education. And also, I think she highlighted this, that one of the reasons why you also go to an elite college is also for the contacts. Now that could that plays a bigger role in graduate school, but you go for also the contacts. If you get into the Harvard or Chicago or Stern School or whatever it is, the idea is that you're going to be with people who are also going to are in an upward trajectory as well, and you make the contacts. And also, the other question for the guest is, I think you went to Yale or have like some master's degrees from some high-end institutions. How did that, had you feel that that helped you? Do you think you would have been able to write a book and be at a think tank if you went to CUNY or Queensborough Community College? I'm just curious about that.
Yeah, I think that's an absolutely fair question. I want to kind of reel it back a little bit and say that this revolution is not about blowing up Harvard or reinventing the top of the scale, but that 85% of the students in this country are at non-selective institutions that accept more than half of the people that apply. And half of our college students are at community colleges. And millions of people don't get to go to college at all. So what this revolution is really about is opening up access to people that have no access to elite colleges, let alone, the kinds of communities and opportunities that are available at a place like Yale. The fact is that it's a tiny, minuscule percentage of people that get to take advantage of these, of the advantages of a selective institution. I mean, that's what selectivity is all about. And what I'm talking about is the open access movement is offering the opportunity for people who go to CUNY to get a piece of the Yale experience.
Anya Kamenetz, author of DIYU, Edupunks, Edupreneurs, and the Coming Transformation of Higher Education, and Chris in Oyster Bay. You're on WNYC. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how you doing? Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, my real question is, I'm a professional musician and a product of the SUNY system. I went to SUNY Potsdam, the Crane School of Music. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, I live in a very unique area such as Long Island, where the private college market is much more dominant than SUNY or CUNY or anything else. There's more private schools down here than anywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And how are they preparing students better than the SUNY system? Where, from my experience, I feel like other SUNY and CUNY graduates just seem like they're more prepared and they have less debt after graduation.
Well, I think this goes back to what we were talking about before, which is that the conversation we're having about higher education is too often about prestige and not about quality, real quality. And, you know, the private schools have the ability to project an image of prestige, which is done by imitating the Ivy Leagues, however they're able to do that. But what really counts in higher education is the quality of learning and the quality of the community that's there. So, you know, the more that people feel that they're priced, and the problem is that as tuition goes up, people paradoxically feel like it's more and more valuable. You know, what they're paying for is what they're getting, they assume. And so it's really hard to have a conversation about reducing costs and improving quality at the same time, which is the crucial thing that we need to do.
Chris, thank you for your call. By the way, honey, where did you go? The previous caller asked, did you go to Yale?
I graduated from Yale in 2002.
Did you get good value, in your opinion?
I would say that I did, yes. I pursued part of a personal learning path while I was there as well. I did 3 internships, and my senior year, I actually reduced my course load so that I could go and work at the Village Voice. And that was not a traditional Ivy League thing to do.
Do you think there are ways that we can find out what the outputs actually are from colleges? You say there are some things, you know, that they're all looking for this ranking on the U.S. News and World Report list, but they're not being measured by how much students learn, by how well they do after school in various ways. I mean, what do you think the most important outcome measurements are, and is there any way of finding them out when assessing a particular school?
I talked to the U.S. News and World Report people about this, and they claim that there's not really good numbers out there for a lot of things. There are alternative measures rising up, though. There are things like the National Survey of Student Engagement, the Collegiate Learning Assessment, which are attempts, voluntary attempts by colleges to actually find out what kids are learning and how they're doing. Some states like Texas have better measurements on a statewide level for finding out who goes in and who comes out, so you may be able to check on your state. But really what has to happen ultimately, and I think that there's some movement on this on the federal level, is to push for more openness. Again, it's about openness. It's about colleges being transparent and releasing the information that they themselves have.
Bob in Rego Park, you're on WNYC with Anya Kamenetz. Hi.
Brian, continue to do an amazing job. I just want to say my son's going to be graduating Brandeis. I just wanted to mention the fact that the magazine that I get from Brandeis indicated that probably about 80% of the money you pay a school, for example, paying $50,000 a year goes to the professors. So basically parents are letting professors live like kings. They have great pensions. They put $6 million a year. The experience of college, the most important thing is the contacts you make at school. Of course, my son, when you go to a fine school, the job that you'll get, they're looking for the top school students who worked hard. But I would recommend, if you can, work hard in high school and go to the best school you can.
Bob, thank you. Well, what about professor salaries, Anya? I don't know if you reference that in your book or if you agree that that's a problem.
It's a sticky issue because on one hand, yes, about 75% of a college budget goes into salaries. However, a lot of that is staff and administration. That's where really the line items have been growing. And on the faculty side, what we're seeing is actually what they call the casualization of academic labor. So more and more credit hours are being covered by TAs, by graduate students, not by full-on, and by adjuncts, not full-on professors. So there's a cushy layer, and my parents have just, they're retiring from Louisiana State University, where they're both professors, and they're definitely part of that cushy layer of tenured people. But beneath that, there is a growing cadre of people who are very underpaid and overworked, and they're not part of the problem. They really want to be part of the solution. My solution that I suggest in the book is that technology, in a lot of different ways, can reduce the burden on faculty time and raise faculty productivity, which, again, has been a dirty word in higher ed for far too long.
Here's kind of the opposite question from our comments page. MH writes, how do you propose to pay the faculty for this free educational material that you advocate? It is their research that is driving some of the best courses.
Well, professors that do research within universities have a long tradition of sharing that broadly with the public, and that is really what they're supposed to do. And the question is, yes, how do you compensate people who are content creators in that way? It's a question that is problematic right now in the media world where I work, in the music world, all across society. As the cost of delivering these materials goes down, there's this question of how to pay creators. I don't think it should stand in our way in terms of reinventing the way that education is delivered to students, because I think that you should be able to get your education just as easily and just as cheaply, in the sense of not too many extra costs, as you can get your music now from iTunes.
Although comparing it to the music industry or the publishing industry, I mean, higher education seems to be flourishing, hardly going extinct, like the music and publishing, you know, at the top almost are doing, because we're trying to make college universal in our society. So why the comparison with publishing and the record industries?
Well, I mean, Brian, I'm arguing that the thin ice is the thin ice. I think that the revolution that we're on the brink of is not been seen in higher education, because higher education is a multi-level institution. It's not just the content industry. It's got the socialization, the accreditation, and it's very locked up in federal programs, state programs, and very strong culturally as well. But what I'm arguing is that higher education cannot ignore the effects of the information delivery revolution to the extent that they're in the information delivery business.
Before you go, did you notice in the New York Times yesterday it said, despite the recession, applications to the most elite selective universities were way up this year. Penn had a 20% increase in applications.
Yep.
And Stanford, Harvard, MIT, the rest in that category also saw increases. How do you explain it?
Well, number one, the problem is not on the top. The problem is, again, with the 85% of students at the non-selective institutions and the millions who are not getting college at all. And number two, the problem is not on the demand side, because students need information in an information society. The problem is on the supply side, and the question is, can we break the cost spiral? Can we get advantage of these technological revolutions to actually get education to everyone that needs it? Because, by the way, Brian, the national goal of getting 60% by 2020, insiders told me, you know, it is not going to happen at this way, at this rate. There's no way.
DIYU is the name of the book, subtitled EduPunks, Edupreneurs, and the Coming Transformation of Higher Education by Anya Kamenetz. You may know her from her previous Generation Debt, for which she's been on the show many times. She writes for Fast Company as well. Anya, very provocative and very important. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Still to come this hour, Adam Davidson from NPR's Planet Money next. He's been in Haiti this week on whether more donations even matter right now. And just in time for opening day, two editors of Baseball Prospectus, where jocks and math geeks find something to talk about. Stay with us.